Welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesemann, and I'm your host. On today's program, we're going to do a slightly early year-end wrap-up. It's become an annual thing. My friend John Anderson from DIYmedia.net, as well as the producer of Free Press's Media Minutes, is here in the studio with me. We'll talk about what's going on this year in unlicensed and pirate radio, as well as other things going on with the FCC and our other boys in Washington. It's going to be a fun half hour. You really want to stay tuned. Well, thanks for joining me here, John.
It's always fun.
It's always a lot of fun. It's gotten a lot more fun since you started living here in Champaign-Urbana.
Yes.
And we don't have to do this over the phone.
No.
We can do this right here live in the WEFT studios. A lot of people probably who listen to this program and some of the affiliate stations don't realize what a hotbed of indie media, independent media it is here in little old Champaign-Urbana,
yes.
Illinois.
Yes, you are correct.
Since you produce the Media Minutes program for Free Press, which is heard locally in Champaign-Urbana as part of Bob McChesney's program on public station WLLL, but
Media
is also
Matters.
Carried on a bunch of other commuting public stations around the country.
Three dozen. Yes, community, low-power FM, pirate, and public radio stations all around the country carry Media Minutes now. And two stations overseas, one in Australia and one in New Zealand, because there is apparently unmet demand for news about media policy analysis about the United States in those countries. But I'm very happy that they're playing them.
Well,
so
you know,
I can't not.
They do get affected since these are all transnational entities at this point
in time.
That's
right. It's a global world. We're providing a global service. The internet makes it happen, folks.
Indeed it does. So let's start off a bit with one of the topic we often talk about when you're here, and that's unlicensed in pirate radio.
Yes.
Was it last year when Florida passed its law, or was that this year?
That was last year. Last year, that actually was a bill that was being debated throughout the year. I think it passed sometime in July. It makes unlicensed broadcasting a third-degree felony punishable by up to something like 5 years in prison and a massive amount of fine action. Two people have actually been arrested under this. It's happened earlier this year. They've been charged, but their case is kind of in that, I don't know, judicial limbo. And there's actually a push on the FCC by the ARRL, the American Radio Relay League, which is the primary trade organization for amateur or ham radio operators around the country. They've petitioned the FCC to actually declare the Florida law null and void, because throughout the FCC's entire regulatory history, it has fought tooth and nail to claim exclusive jurisdiction over the regulation of the airwaves. And now here comes this state stepping in and saying, no, we want partial jurisdiction over the broadcast bans, and we're going to start criminally prosecuting people. The FCC has turned kind of a blind eye to Florida's doings because Florida is such a hotbed of pirate radio activity. In fact, in a newspaper, I want to say it's the Washington Post, but I could be wrong, the district director of the Tampa FCC office actually said, this is great. Under this law, we don't even have to be called at all. Which, again, goes completely in contradiction to everything the FCC has tried to do to assert exclusive jurisdiction over the airwaves. But like with any other controversial proposal the FCC receives, they put this one in the wonderful circular file, and there has been no action on this petition for a declaratory ruling from the FCC, and there probably won't be any for who knows how long, until some case actually goes to state court, and then the attorneys of the accused will have to argue this point in court, which sucks for the accused, but it doesn't look like it's going to work itself out any other way.
Yeah, it does suck, because it'll have to then bounce around state court, then the federal court.
Yeah.
It won't be a simple run, and of course it means you have to have an attorney willing to take on that level of a case, and that's likely not going to be a free defense attorney.
Communications regulation is one of those esoteric points of law that not a lot of people have experience in, and a lot of courts are not comfortable in dealing with.
And so the guys who do know it charge $500 an hour
coin
and up.
Yes. Unfortunately, though, there is, I don't want to call it a trend, but there's another state which is debating the exact same thing, and that's the state of New Jersey.
Oh, my old home state.
That's right. They have a bill pending currently in the state Senate. It's already passed the state assembly. It was just voted out of committee in the state Senate on December 1st. This bill would make unlicensed broadcasting a fourth-degree felony, punishable by up to 18 months in prison and a massive amount of fine action.
And the situation's a little bit in New Jersey, because I'm not aware that New Jersey has a pirate radio problem even close to on par with Florida.
No.
But the difference is that New Jersey, the entire state, and especially the media of the state, live in the eternal shadow of New York and Philadelphia.
Right.
And so there don't tend to be a lot of local stations or locally oriented stations throughout
right.
the state. People are really listening to Philadelphia and New York radio, and so the New Jersey-based broadcasters are very, very, very defensive.
They're very protective of their spectrum turf, and mm-hmm. if anyone tries to squeeze in on it, they're going to get the smackdown, and this is the way they're trying to do it in perpetuity now.
I wonder, do you know, are there any low-power FM stations in New Jersey?
Not offhand.
That's something we could look up, but
yes.
I mean, I'm curious because it is such a densely urban state. It's the most densely populated state in the country, almost 8 million people or around 8 million people in a very, you know, something much smaller than Illinois and most states in the Midwest. And I'm not sure there is any real free spectrum to be had there, or if there's any place that would be considered rural, except maybe in the extreme southeast of the state when you get away, you know, towards Atlantic City, or maybe in the extreme northwest where you're relatively far away from New York and on the other end far away from Philadelphia. Because I don't think Delaware is much of a towering influence.
No.
No. And then, you know, to all you Delaware residents, that's not meant as a slight.
Right.
Though we have no affiliates yet in Delaware.
Not
so
yet.
I guess we can go ahead and impugn them. We have no affiliates in New Jersey either, for that matter.
Not yet. Right.
So I guess you're over there tapping away. I don't know if you're looking that up.
I'm trying to look. I'm looking at a database right now, but it's not showing me whether or not the stations are low power or not, so I can't really tell you.
And so we don't know if the FCC will, and you know, we guess the FCC probably will not, at least right now, take up this issue of Florida's state law. I guess the AARL. Is that right?
ARRL.
ARRL. Yeah. See, I get it all. ARSP.
ARRL.
Probably don't have as much clout at the FCC as they once did.
Well, no, and that's kind of the funny thing. I mean, you would think that they would, especially in this wonderful post 9/11 world we live in. Where,
right, where the hams really came to the rescue.
Hurricane
both.
Katrina, you know, and all that. The hams came out of the woodwork. They established communication with communities that were completely cut off by traditional communication systems. You'd think that they would have something going on here. They would have some sort of public safety clout, but that's not the way this is going. In fact, the ruling itself, the petition that the hams have filed to actually try to force the FCC to declare the Florida law null and void, is being heard by the Wireless Telecommunications Bureau. Not even like the media bureau or the people that typically regulate the broadcast.
Or can the enforcement bureau hear these
things? You would think the enforcement
things?
Bureau might be a place for this kind of stuff to land, but that's not the case. It's actually in kind of a semi-obscure bureau of the FCC that's got to deal with this, and sounds like they've just been told to sit on it for an indefinite period of time.
Yeah, they got other things they want to worry about.
Yep.
And I noticed that you reported earlier in the week that some micro radio has recently been used in a protest by Greenpeace.
Yes, Greenpeace did a protest at Hewlett-Packard's international headquarters in Palo Alto, California, earlier this week. I want to say it was on Monday or Tuesday. And they put up a huge, like, balloon, blimp of some sort, and they did a banner drop from the blimp, which basically chastised Hewlett-Packard for using toxic materials in their computers and other electronics, which then, of course, get shipped overseas to these massive e-waste dumps where people, usually kids even, work with little to no tools tearing apart this stuff, and they get contaminated with heavy metals, and it's just generally a bad scene for the environment. And as part of this banner drop protest action happening at the Hewlett-Packard headquarters, someone with Greenpeace acquired a micro radio transmitter and set it up on a local frequency of like 91.3 or something, and broadcast a small repeating message for people that were driving by the corporate headquarter campus location saying, this is why we're out here, this is what we're doing, this is where Hewlett-Packard is screwing up. If you would like to affect change, call the CEO, Mark Hurd, at blah, 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 or email him and tell him that he ought to change his company's ways. Which is a tactic that's actually been used in the past. There have been plenty of times when people have set up, you know, like picket lines or stuff like that, and people will bring out a small micro radio transmitter that can be heard within maybe a mile or a half mile, and they'll hold up signs saying tune to a certain frequency, and then they'll get this message. The last time that I can remember this happening was back last year when the FCC actually showed up in San Antonio, Texas, for a hearing on localism. San Antonio, Texas, of course, being the headquarters of Clear Channel Communications, a group of people dressed up as pirates went down to Clear Channel's headquarters and stood on the corner with a micro radio transmitter broadcasting about the evils of Clear Channel and why people should contact the FCC and let them know that they should care about regulating the airwaves in a localism favorative fashion.
Now, it's possible to do one of these things with a transmitter that is technically legal.
Yes.
Do you know if the Greenpeace folks use one of these? They're so-called Part 15 transmitters because they fall under the Part 15 regulations that govern unlicensed transmissions.
No, I don't know if they were actually using a licensed, you know, something that falls within what's considered to be a usable power level, which is only, you know, several hundred milliwatts. And can only be heard for several hundred feet. They often are used for things like what they call talking houses, where you know, a house is for sale and there will be a little sign out front, and then you tune to a frequency and you hear all about the wonderful amenities of the house. I don't know if they were actually doing that. There's only been one news report that was been filed about this, and what it said was it could only be heard near the company's site. So there is no real estimation as far as how far out they got, but you know, they're probably using a watt.
Yeah.
I think probably was above the legal limits, but because you're doing a protest that's a very quick, limited duration, you're only on the air for a quick, limited duration. The chances of the FCC coming after you during that time are so infinitesimally small that it's worth the risk of doing.
Right. The FCC aren't cops. They aren't police officially in that they have no police powers. But secondarily, it's not like you can call the FCC 911. Report a transmitter downstairs or down the street or whatever, and expect to see the agents to show up as quickly as paramedics would to the scene of an accident.
This is very true. You can call the FCC and file a complaint, and then essentially what they do is they make a note of it, they put it in a file, and when they get around to going after pirates, they'll pull all of their complaints out in one pile and work through the pile. So it's a very easy a way to use radio without getting in trouble.
And
the temporary autonomous broadcast.
They are a bureaucracy.
Yes.
And they will deal with it in a bureaucratic fashion. So speaking about how the FCC has dealt with unlicensed broadcasters this year, you keep a database on your website at diymedia.net where you go through all the reported enforcement actions. Now, you use both the FCC's own records, and do you also use records of people who report to you or report somewhere on the web?
Yes. Oftentimes, people will say, hey, I got dimed by the FCC, and they'll post it to possibly a bulletin board somewhere that deals with free radio. They might put it on a news group. A lot of times, they'll contact me directly because they know that I keep this information. And the FCC is not very forthcoming as to data about the stations that they bust. The only information you can really get is the address of where the station was busted, but nothing about how much power it might have been running, how high its antenna was, how long it's been on the air, the reason for contact or anything like that typically comes from the actual unlicensed broadcaster.
And so where are we this year? Has this been a big year for pirate busts?
Yeah, well, if you just look at the raw numbers, it's actually been a pretty big year. I'm looking over my own numbers right now, and I've logged a total of 89 enforcement actions. Enforcement actions are determined by actual contact between the FCC and a micro radio station. This can happen in a number of forms. It can happen through the FCC agents physically visiting the station. It can happen through FCC agents coming in with federal marshals and conducting a raid. It can also happen postally, meaning that the FCC might send a warning letter, what they call a notice of unlicensed operation.
Is that called going postal on you?
Right. Or they might get a little bit more feisty and send what's called a notice of apparent liability, which has a dollar figure attached to it, i.e., we will fine you $10,000 if you don't shut up now. Each one of those I count as a specific enforcement action, so often in my own database that I keep online, you'll see more than one entry for one station. So while the FCC has conducted 89 enforcement actions, a good rule of thumb is to divide that number at least by two. And that's the number of stations that they've actually affected over the course of 2005. That being said, the number of enforcement actions has already surpassed 2004's numbers. And we're still half a month, more than half a month left in the year. In fact, I was just looking on the FCC's own website where they list a lot of the postal contacts they make, notices of violation, notices of apparent liability, and things like that. And there have been, since the last time I updated the website, one, two, three, at least three other enforcement actions, which I'm going to have to go through and look up.
Where have those been? Can you see right
two off? In Philadelphia.
Philadelphia. Okay.
One is actually going after two individuals, and the other one apparently is a synagogue of some sort.
What's interesting is
a rabbi has actually been for broadcasting on 90.5 megahertz.
And, you know, that's not unusual, as I've noticed looking through these listings. It often that there are churches that run radio stations, probably often somewhat unaware that what they're doing is illegal.
Right.
I think, who get visited by the FCC. And I'm looking at your map to see the hot spots here. And it's interesting to kind of look at it because the broad midsection of the country, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, I don't think people be surprised to say Montana doesn't see a lot of action, you know, being a relatively not, you know, sparsely populated rural state. But even Illinois, we see no actions for the year. We see no actions in Wisconsin and through the Middle Atlantic, pretty much. New Jersey being one where we don't see action. And I know that there are stations running in New Jersey.
Yeah. The reason for that, I think, is not so much because the FCC isn't actually doing anything in these states. It's because that the enforcement activity of the FCC is actually scattered nationwide and broken up among at least two dozen field offices. There are several field offices scattered throughout the country. They range in different sizes depending on if they're a headquarters office or just a small outpost office or something like that. And not all field offices report enforcement actions uniformly. Typically, the offices out west tend to do a pretty good job at reporting. The ones in California do. The ones in Florida do a pretty good job of reporting because they want to show that they're out there, you know, showing the flag and busting some heads as far as radio piracy goes. And the offices in the Northeast, Philadelphia, New York, places like that are pretty good about reporting. Chicago doesn't seem to do a lot of either. They're not doing a lot of enforcement actions this year, or they just haven't gotten around to reporting it to the headquarters.
They've done some in Indiana.
Yeah, they did one in Indiana earlier this year. But just because the data is not there in the database doesn't necessarily mean the FCC has not been out on the prowl. We just find out about it way after the fact.
And you are listening to Media Geek. My name is Paul Rees-Madill, and I'm your host. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My guest today is John Anderson. He puts together the website www.diymedia.net, which is the best source for news about pirate and unlicensed radio, be it the activity, be it the way the FCC comes down, policy, and all that sort of good stuff. He's also the producer of Media Minutes, which is put out by Free Press. It's a weekly 5-minute news wrap-up for the intersection of media and democracy.
Yes.
That's a very busy intersection.
Yes, it is.
I think a lot of people get hit out
Fender
there.
Benders all the time, people sweeping up glass all the time. It's a mess at the intersection.
It's a good thing you're there.
Democracy.
It's a good thing you're there to keep tabs on it. Do you have a copter?
Yeah, that's right. I had live Chopper 5 over the intersection of media and democracy. That's me.
And DIYmedia.net is also the other thing that it's your best source for is truthful translations.
Yes, collage, media collage. If you would like to hear presidents, politicians, and other people, their rhetoric manipulated to actually be halfway truthful and put to a nice beat you can dance to, DIYmedia.net's another place to look. Truthful translations of political speech. There's 403 individual cuts of goodness up online right now.
I really need to comb through there again and start playing some more on the program.
Sure.
Here.
That's great.
As my bumpers. I'm trying to go more Creative Commons, and those are kind of Creative Commons.
If it's up on my site, it's fair game.
They're vaguely rights-free.
It's fair game. No, everyone who I've posted stuff to, I have permission.
Okay.
They said that I can share it, and it's all good. And you find that actually among people that do collage work, people that do, you know, art that involves appropriation, like to share and like to spread it around because they're doing kind of the same thing in reverse, and they want to put it back out there. So yes, definitely use and abuse.
And so looking back at the FCC, it's been a less sort of effective year for the FCC ever since Kevin Martin came on board as chair, because he hasn't quite had a full house.
Yeah, no, it's I haven't really quite fully understood Kevin Martin. I'm still trying to get my hands, my finger on Kevin Martin as a regulator. I'm not quite sure what he's all about. I know he's a very strong Christian, has very strong moral beliefs, is willing to make compromises.
Much more so than Michael Powell. I think he's much more a much more politically savvy in that he kind of knows a bit more how to play the game.
He looks younger than I do, though. That's the scary thing. The guy running the FCC looks like he's 12. He looks like he's Doogie Howser. It's crazy.
Doogie Howser, FCC.
It's crazy. I mean, you got to find a picture of this guy. It's crazy. He looks like he's 12. But, you know.
And Jonathan Adelstein would look young, too, if it wasn't for the receding hairline.
Yeah, definitely.
Otherwise, he would be able to match. It's just because he's kept his hair. I think that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
But so the FCC's been two commissioners down. Oh, actually, been one commissioner down the entire year, meaning that we have an even number of Democrats, Republicans, which makes it hard for the Republicans to push their agenda quite the same way that Michael Powell did, especially on hot-button issues like media ownership, which means that Kevin Martin's been putting off revising the media ownership rules, which he has been ordered to do so, to revise them by the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia, but he keeps putting it off because he does not have a majority. And he was about to get a majority because someone to replace Michael Powell has been named by the Bush administration, although the confirmation hearing has not yet happened. But now Kathleen Abernathy, the other Republican on the commission, has to go because her term was actually up earlier this year and she was allowed to stay on till the end of the congressional term. And so she has stepped down, leaving it once again. Well, actually, right now, it's one Republican and two Democrats.
Yep. Which means... and
a very unusual situation, because typically the party in power has the majority.
But the key here is that the chairman controls the agenda.
Right, right.
So Kevin Martin will just have no business done until he can get a majority back on the FCC, or at least until he gets parity with 2-2.
He might want to run some of the indecency stuff, since he has a fair majority there.
Well, the people who are saying that the indecency... there's been a lot of industry watchers and agency watchers that are predicting that because the FCC last year, as you know, they did a record amount of indecency enforcement fine action, more than they've ever done in any year. And Kevin Martin came in and said that, you know, indecency and family-friendly programming was kind of his bailiwick. But then there have been none, zero indecency enforcement fines this whole entire year. Now, what agency watchers think is going to happen is before the end of the year, the FCC is going to release a buttload of indecency fines all in one fell swoop that, as an aggregate, add up to a huge number, which is impressive, which will then show that the FCC still cares about this and is actively pursuing this.
Another thing I've heard is that they may try to aggregate them and go after particular companies, particular large owners, to get large agreements, like they did with Infinity, which owns the Howard Stern Show.
Right.
But there have been two possible candidates that are circulating right now to fill Kathleen Abernathy's now vacated chair. And what's interesting is both of them come from the telecom industry.
Mm-hmm.
They're not media folks.
Yep.
And for a lot of people who don't know a lot about the FCC, you may not realize them. The majority of what the FCC concerns itself with are things like telecommunications, telephone, two-way radio, satellite communications, things like that. And media, while it's a big part, is not the majority. And in fact, you know, as we're seeing convergence happens, it seems like telecom laws are going to become more important, and may even cede the media laws may cede in favor of telecom laws. But that's it's going to be an interesting thing. So the two candidates that have come up right now is a lobbyist, Robert McDowell, and a communications attorney whose name is William Crispin, and they've both worked for many of the big. Many of the big communications companies. McDowell is senior vice president, assistant general counsel with CompTel, which does a lot of lobbying on behalf of so-called competing Bell companies.
It's actually kind of a trade organization.
Yeah, but it's really he's really a lobbyist.
Yes, he is.
And so they represent not the big behemoths like SBC or Verizon, but smaller ones like Quest.
Or McLeod USA.
Or a lot of companies that work in the margins, provide long-distance services, in specially cases and things like that. And then the other guy, William Crispin, is a communications attorney, and he's had some other big names like Qualcomm and Nextel. He's really specialized in wireless, which, of course, is becoming a huge, huge industry and therefore a big political football.
Crispin's wife? lobbyist for AT&T.
Yeah, there you go. Which is now SBC.
Well, they've appropriated the AT&T name.
Yes.
So now it's a
AT&T is SBC, but it's AT&T.
Right. One big happy family again.
One big happy
Say
family.
Say hi to
again.
Mom.
Ma Bell. There's just two. You just have two moms now. You have a mom and a stepmom. Verizon and SBC. And so my guess is, I've been digging around on these guys, that they're not exactly going to be big critics of big telecom. Although it seems like McDowell, since he has represented so many of the smaller companies, I use that in quotes, over the years, may not be such a big friend of SBC or Verizon. But that remains to be seen.
Well, you know, I look at it this way. A lot of what's going to happen as far as what our telecom regulatory policy landscape looks like in the next year or two is actually going to take place in Congress. The FCC is the body who is in charge of executing the legislation passed down by Congress. So Congress tells them to jump, and the FCC jumps. If you have people in positions of executive authority that are willing to execute legislation favorable to incumbent telecommunications providers, it just makes the execution process that's much more easy to grease along and get implemented in a quote, fair and judicious manner, which is anything but. It might also be interesting in that, you know, commissioners have staff. They may employ staff to write reports and do analyses to help push certain planks or provisions in a rewrite of telecommunications legislation. As I think you mentioned on your program last week, 16 hearings have been scheduled by the Senate Commerce Committee dealing with a myriad of telecommunications reform legislation.
All within like the first 2 months of the
January,
the session.
February, right.
Yeah.
So there's going to be a lot of legislative activity happening on the pike, and a lot of that is eventually going to trickle down and point the direction in which the FCC is supposed to regulate. And if you have people that are, in sync with the lobbyists who are working to get their legislation passed as law, you just kind of grease the skids all the way down.
If you go to MediaGeek.net, www.MediaGeek.net, right on the front page still is a rundown of all of these different hearings. And some of the big things that are going to be coming up, I think, are issues like internet neutrality, meaning does your internet provider have to pass along all the data you want, whether it's video, audio, or whatever it is, things like the broadcast an audio flag, which will have bearing over whether or not you can record things. There's some big, big issues coming up, and it's going to be quite a fight, I think, for the public interest.
I plan on doing a story on this for Media Minutes in the near future, so stay tuned to there.
And how can people hear Media Minutes?
You can get it on web. We podcast and we broadcast. If you want to get it yourself individually, check it out at your own leisure. Go to the following website, www.freepress.net/Media Minutes. And that's the place where you'll be able to download the show in broadcast quality MP3 format every Friday.
And your website is DIYmedia.net. John Anderson, thanks again for coming in this week, as usual. And right like that. I hope it was that fast for the listeners. But for us, it was that fast. And speaking of listeners, I want to say hello to a new station joining the Media Geek Network here, WRFALP in Jamestown, New York. And that's in the Chautauqua area of far western New York State. A very, very pretty area. And in fact, that station is run by a local arts council.
Oh, nice.
In the Chautauqua area.
And they obviously have good taste in programming.
That remains to be seen. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'll be back in 1 week with more news of our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at www.mediageek.org. There you'll find the Media Geek blog with frequently updated news and views on independent media. You'll also find archive editions of the program in MP3 and the open-source Ogg Vorbis format. You can also subscribe to the podcast to have the program automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. The closing music is Fire in the Sky by Adam Luo. Media Geek is produced live at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Portions of the program are pre-recorded at Media Geek Studios. Media Geek is also aired on community radio stations KQRP in Salida, California, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, and WTND in Macomb, Illinois. And Media Geek is free to air on your local, non-commercial, or community radio station, too. Just email Paul at mediageek.org. You can use that email address to send comments, too. I'm always interested to know what you think of the show. Again, that's Paul at mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.